Cuba was proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KBOO's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KBOO Jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's 9:03. Coming up this morning on KBOO, it's Political Perspectives. And this morning at 9, coming right up, host Jenka Soderberg interviews Ava Bartlett about the reality of life in Gaza, including the dangers posed to fishers, farmers, and anyone in the border regions. At 9:30, we'll hear Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock reporting on the plan to dump hundreds of thousands of tons of radioactive water from Fukushima right into the Pacific Ocean. And we hear about a group battling a sulfide mine proposed for an ecologically sensitive area in northern Minnesota. At 10 o'clock, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on the Dirtbag, it's the second annual Beekeeping Edition. Host Glenn Andreessen and guest Jim Gilbert welcome Portland Urban Beekeepers President Tim Wessels to talk about beekeeping in the city. They'll also discuss the aftermath of the Arctic cold blast and how to evaluate the health of your plants. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thank you so much, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Good morning. My name is Jenka Soderberg. Joining us today is Ava Bartlett. She is an independent Canadian activist and freelance journalist who spent long periods in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip volunteering with the International Solidarity Movement, reporting from the ground. She's currently on tour and will be in Portland tomorrow, that's Thursday, December 12th, at 5 p.m. at the Red and Black Cafe at Southeast 12th and Oak. Thanks for joining us today, Ava.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jenka.
Well, let's start by talking about the people of Gaza. Who are they? I know many of them are refugees. And how did they come to live in this coastal strip with so many people crowded in such a small space?
Well, yeah, so roughly 70% of the 1.7 million people in the Gaza Strip are refugees, and the remaining, roughly third are inhabitants that have lived there, their families have lived there for generations. But the refugees were both expelled from their native homes in 1948 with the creation of the State of Israel and the expulsion of Palestinians from their land, and also in 1967 with the 1967 war in which Israel occupied the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and also more refugees were expelled. So now they live in very densely packed refugee camps in horrible conditions. Many of them aren't hooked up to water or sewage lines or electrical lines. And so their existence is quite difficult, to say the least. Mm.
And most recently, since 2007, there's been a siege on the Gaza Strip. Who has put that siege in place, and what are the reasons that are given for it?
It's funny because in the corporate media, when you hear about it, it would be described in many cases as an economic siege, as if this is something, a light punishment. And it is actually a collective punishment, but nonetheless, it's much more than an economic siege. It was imposed by the Israeli authorities, and backed by Canada was among the first nations, and America as well, in supporting this blockade or siege on Gaza. Basically, Hamas was elected through democratic elections in 2006, and shortly after, my country, Canada, cut ties with Palestinian authorities, or, you know, Palestinian political figures, specifically in Gaza. And then in 2007, when Hamas assumed control of the Gaza Strip, Israel imposed this siege on Gaza, saying that this is, well, their reasons are vary. Sometimes it's about security, sometimes it's about, they have a number of lexicon they would use, but in reality what it is collective punishment. It may be perhaps Israel's attempt to persuade the population of Gaza to overthrow Hamas, but that's a ridiculous and inhumane reason to collectively punish 1.7 million people. And it's illegal as well. I mean, the people elected the government, whether or not our governments happen to like Hamas, they were democratically elected. So there's no legal reason to impose a siege on the people.
Mm. And what are some of the effects of the siege on the population there? I know most recently we've heard about sewage floods in parts of Gaza City.
Yeah, and this is a culmination of Israeli policies in Gaza, even prior to the siege, severely limiting, well, so with the siege, severely limiting goods that are able to enter Gaza. And even from 2007 to 2010, items that were allowed into Gaza were limited to all but 40 items. So construction materials are not among the items allowed in, and they currently still are not allowed in. But even other things, just to speak on the siege itself, aside from the sewage, which I'll get to in a second, but even among the items banned were things like milk formula or food items or fertilizers or seeds or livestock, et cetera, obviously impacting on Palestinians' ability to be as self-sufficient as possible in Gaza. But then aside from that, so when you think about construction materials, just with normal population growth, sewage and sanitation lines need to be maintained, holding pools need to be expanded, and this hasn't been allowed in Gaza, meaning that these antiquated holding pools can't hold, you know, they can't cope with the population growth. So particularly in this time of year when it is the rainy season, you have the combination of heavy rains and pools that are not large enough to contain the sewage that that is there, and at the same time you have power cuts which last up to 18 hours a day, meaning that the sewage in the holding pools can't even be pumped into the sea as is normally done for want of ability to treat the sewage. So then you do have sewage actually overflowing into the streets, like in the Zaytun district of Gaza City. And even back in 2007, this was already a precedent. Even before, you know, I mean, even in the early days of the siege, we had a sewage holding pool in Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia, I should say, in northern Gaza, overflow and kill 4 people. This is completely preventable, but the problem is that Palestinians haven't been allowed to import the construction materials and maintain these pools and their lines.
Mm. And the construction materials that you're talking about have become increasingly important since the attack in 2008, 2009, in which many Palestinian homes were destroyed. You were there at that time. Can you talk a bit about that Israeli invasion of Gaza?
Sure. With regard to the destruction itself, not even just speaking of the human element, but, you know, thousands of homes and businesses were completely destroyed and tens of thousands more were damaged. And so not allowing construction materials in to rebuild these homes is significant. And to this day, there are still Palestinians that are living in tents because they can't afford to rent, for example, a home in another area, and they can't rebuild. And then, of course, the businesses that were damaged, many of them have not been rebuilt, or the factories have not been rebuilt. But the attacks themselves were horrific. I mean, I'm just, I'd never experienced anything like that. So it was an eye-opener for me. But even for Gazans, for Palestinians from Gaza who have lived through many attacks, they said that this was the worst thing they had experienced. And the older generation said it was the worst thing since the Nakba, or their expulsion in 48. Israel relentlessly bombed Gaza for 23 days, even beyond the so-called ceasefire, from the sky, from Apache helicopters, from warplanes, from the sea, from gunboats, also from tanks. And, of course, using drone technology, which has, you know, the ability to precision bomb targets. another aspect of their bombing was, in speaking of drones, is the what they call the double tap or the double knock method, in which a site is bombed and a few minutes later the site is rebombed, thereby hitting people who have come to help any survivors. The Israeli army ruthlessly attacked medics when they were trying to perform their emergency work, and this is obviously illegal. It's against the Geneva Conventions. 16 medics were killed, and tens of ambulances were destroyed and damaged. Hospitals were targeted, including with white phosphorus. The more notable use of white phosphorus was the attack right next to the Fallujah High School, which was a UN school in which people were taking sanctuary. Over 40 people were killed in this attack using white phosphorus. And this was a very densely inhabited area. So white phosphorus apparently is permitted to be used in warfare, but not in civilian areas. And that's precisely what the Israeli army did throughout Gaza.
Has the Israeli government faced any type of international repercussions for that 2008-2009 invasion with these violations of international law that you're talking about?
No, absolutely not. I mean, so again, my own country, Canada, was among the first countries to oppose any sort of UN resolution condemning Israel for its war crimes and its atrocities during those attacks on Gaza. The U.S. also, I believe, opposed the resolution or the condemnation. And even a report that was written by Judge Goldstone was, although it was fairly in-depth, it was then, you know, it wasn't given any, it wasn't passed on or adopted by the U.N. It wasn't, nothing was enforced. There's no body, the U.N. or the ICC, there's no body that actually punishes Israel for its illegal and criminal acts. And this whole thing repeated in 2012, again, with Israel bombing Gaza for 8 days continuously. And in the end, there might be a tut-tut from Ban Ki-moon or somebody from the UN, but nobody actually enforces anything to restrain Israel from these criminal acts. Mm. And this is one of the most appalling things. It's not only can Israel use all sorts of weaponry against a civilian population that are locked within their borders and have no ability to flee and have no bomb shelters. Not only can Israel do that, but it gets away with it time and time again.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Eva Bartlett. She's an independent Canadian activist, freelance journalist who has been living in the Gaza Strip for several years and is talking about the situation for the civilian population in Gaza. She'll be speaking tomorrow in Portland at the Red and Black Cafe. That's Thursday, December 12th at 5 p.m. at the Red and Black Cafe. And Eva, you are describing a pretty horrific situation for the people of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli government has repeatedly tried to justify their siege and their attacks on Gaza, saying that they are, in fact, the ones under attack from rockets fired from the Gaza Strip. What is your response, having lived there and been in the Gaza Strip yourself?
Well, first of all, the proportion, I mean, the balance of power, there is no balance of power. Israel is one of the most well-equipped and well-armed armies in the world and has all sorts of machinery and weaponry that Palestinians do not possess. So, I mean, to compare the rockets, the homemade rockets that are at times sent from Gaza and usually in response to some bombing that Israel has done or another prisoner that's been killed or some criminal act that Israel has done, I mean, there's no comparison between these rockets and the arsenal that Israel deploys on Gaza. Palestinians don't have tanks or helicopters or warships. And Israel has all of these, and as we said, uses them without any sort of condemnation. Living in Gaza, it's a constant state of psychological terror because there are almost always drones in the sky, which are audible and which are unnerving because you're quite aware of what they're capable of. And there are constantly F-16 warplanes in the sky. The Israeli warplanes often release sonic booms, which sound like it's breaking the sound barrier. It sounds actually like an explosion. So these types of things really wear down on the psyche. I mean, add to that the siege and the fact that 80% of the population is dependent on food aid, and unemployment hovers anywhere from 35 to 40% and has done so for years and years. So this manufactured poverty, the manufactured crisis, the fact that 5% of the water is only 5% of the water is drinkable, according to WHO standards, all these different aspects of misery that have been created. Add to that then the psychological warfare of these war machines in the sky and the constant presence of Israeli tanks and jeeps along the border. It's really unbearable. And I mentioned earlier that now we have power outages in Gaza up to 18 hours a day. So that people are in Gaza, I mean, they're obviously very strong and resilient people, but one can only take so much. And they are being just smothered in misery that is completely preventable, but it's also something that's been calculated, part of Israel's slow genocide of Gaza.
Mm. Wow. Pretty strong words. I mean, that it's a genocide of the people of Gaza. Do you think that is the objective then, to wipe out the people of Gaza?
Well, I would ask, in what way does this benefit Israeli security to completely ban any sort of exports, thereby decimating the economy, and also to have drawn up the so-called Red Lines document in which it was calculated exactly how many calories Palestinians in Gaza needed to survive and not quite starve? That has, I mean, I can't find any rational explanation of how that would impact on Israel's security. But on the other hand, it would impact on Palestinians' livelihoods and on the slow genocide. I mean, sometimes it's not a slow genocide. Sometimes you have these waves of attacks in which 1,500 people are killed, or 200 people are killed, or another 200 people are killed. But otherwise, then you have, I mean, with the water being all but 5% drinkable, you have all sorts of waterborne diseases. With the sewage flooding the streets, you have diseases from that. You have malnutrition on the rise, stunting in children. I can't think of a more appropriate word, and I'm not the one, of course, that had coined the use of the word genocide with relation to Israel's policies on Gaza. Numerous activists, including Holocaust survivors like Hedy Epstein, have spoken on this particular aspect and called it what it is. I mean, some people call it Gaza an open-air prison, and other people say, no, that's not adequate. It's not only an open-air prison. It is actually a genocide.
Wow. And a large percentage of the population of Gaza are children. You talked about the growth rate of the population. What's the impact on children, especially young children living in this kind of situation?
There are a variety of horribly negative impacts. The Sonic Boom campaign has impacted on children's hearing, and there's I don't know the actual number of children with hearing disabilities, but it's compared to a so-called normal population, say in North America, the proportion of children that have hearing difficulties or who are deaf is huge compared to what we'd find here. And I mentioned stunting in children's growth, and also this would affect their brain development. The Gaza Community Mental Health Center did a study a few years ago on post-traumatic stress in children and found that over 90% suffered from mild to severe PTSD. And so this impacts on their, you know, ability to study at school. So there's, you know, incidences of bedwetting, all sorts of things related to PTSD. And, I mean, the schools themselves are overcrowded for want of, again, building materials and repairing or rebuilding schools that have been destroyed in Israeli bombings campaigns, and also accommodating population growth. So kids go to school in shifts, either two shifts or three shifts a day, just to enable children to even have some time at school. And I can think of a school actually on the eastern border in the southeast, and it's actually called School of the Martyrs, because this school is, it's less than a kilometer. I can't remember exactly. It might be 500 meters from the border. But the students actually come under regular fire from the Israeli soldiers as they're going to and from school or while they're in school. So this, in those cases, I mean, it actually prevents kids from reaching school or from staying in class. So this is just, you know, one more assault on children's childhoods. And kids in Gaza, they grow up very quickly. I mean, they're mature, they look out for their siblings, but they see things that children should not see.
Mm. It's all an extremely grim situation. I want to move into things that people are doing about this. You yourself have been part of the Free Gaza movement. This is a series of boats that have gone to the Gaza Strip to attempt to break the blockade. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Okay, so a variety of activists back in 2006 got the idea, and we're thinking about it, and it came to fruition in 2008, in August, I believe it was, when the first two boats sailed from Cyprus to Gaza. And the reason they decided to sail boats to Gaza was because Israel controls Palestinian airspace, all the borders with the exception of the southern border, which is controlled by Egypt. And at that time, under Mubarak's rule, Egypt was as complicit as Israel in locking down the borders on Gaza. So the activists decided that, like Free Gaza decided that they would challenge. If Israel says that it has pulled its colonists out of Gaza and therefore Gaza is no longer under Israeli control, okay, if that's the case, then boats should be able to sail through international waters into Palestinian waters. And, I mean, we know now that's not the case, that Israel does militarily still occupy Gaza. But thankfully, these boats were actually able to five times sail from Cyprus to Gaza. I was on the third mission in November, and any boats after that which attempted to reach Palestinian waters were violently prevented by the Israeli Navy, and including ramming the boats and, in all cases, abducting the people aboard and taking them to Israel and deporting them. The more infamous of these attacks would be on the Freedom Flotilla in 2010, in which Israeli commandos airdropped from helicopters, and they airdropped shooting machine guns on the passengers on the Mavi Marmara. And in the end, they killed nine people, including one American citizen, and injured many more, of course, and took everybody to Israel and deported them and kept the boats. So, I mean, it was a very good initiative because Gaza at that time was completely not in the news. It was suffering greatly, but not being spoken of. So this initiative was symbolic in breaking the blockade. It also did bring some hope to Gaza because the people there feel isolated from the world. They're physically isolated, and they're, for the most part, isolated in the media. So when the boat campaign was on, they felt like there are people out there who are actually thinking about us and you know, in solidarity with us. There is a new campaign. It's called Gaza's Ark, and it's actually with many of the people that were involved in Free Gaza, and they have bought an old Palestinian fishing boat and are paying Palestinian laborers to rehabilitate the boat and intend to sail the boat from within Gaza towards the outside world. And on the boat, they'll be carrying things, I mean, symbolic things that could be sold if the borders were open, things that, like date products or other food products or Palestinian embroidery, things that were the borders open, as they should be, and where Palestinians able to trade, then this would be obviously something that would help their economy. So the whole point of the Gaza's Ark is, again, to challenge the blockade and to say, Israel, are you militarily controlling Gaza? And if you are, then you have to provide for the people of Gaza, not deny them almost everything they need to exist.
And what about the role of Egypt? Has there been a shift since the uprising that overthrew Mubarak, and then most recently the shift in power there?
Well, currently, with the recent military coup in July, basically, from my perspective, it's as bad as it was under Mubarak. I mean, the sole crossing that Egypt controls, the Rafah crossing, is closed more often than it is open. And the Egyptian authorities themselves have been complicit in destroying all but roughly 10% of the tunnels that led from Gaza to Egypt. And these tunnels were, many describe them as Gaza's lifeline, because whereas Israel was banning everything you need to exist, again, the diapers, the food, the formula, the seeds, and other things like cars and livestock, the tunnels were bringing these things through. And in some cases, the tunnels were actually being used to export things, like tomatoes were being exported from Gaza to Egypt. So, but the current regime has destroyed all but, I read a UN report and it said 10%, a recent report. So it unfortunately looks like this current regime is as bad as Mubarak's regime was.
Mm. Well, are there...
One thing I would add also is that the tunnels were used to import relatively inexpensive fuel and cooking gas from Egypt. And again, with the closure of the tunnels now, this is yet one more reason why Gaza is plunged into darkness, is that they don't have this inexpensive fuel to run their power plant. And of course, they don't have the cooking gas and the lack of fuel for vehicles as well. All of this is impacting, creating yet more misery in Gaza.
Wow. We only have a minute left, and I wonder if you can talk about what people can do here locally. I know that the U.S. is the largest supporter of the Israeli government, providing $6 to $7 billion a year in aid. What are things that people can do to address the situation in Gaza?
Well, I think that's a very important point, and that U.S. taxpayers should be aware where their tax money is going. And I don't think that many people are aware that U.S. tax money is funding Israel, which is a developed nation and which doesn't need to be the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid, but which actually is. I think that U.S. People in the States need to challenge their congressmen and Senate and actually demand that the halt of U.S. foreign aid to Israel, because this foreign aid is only supplying the Israeli killing machine, really. But also education is important, and challenging the media narrative, because more often than not, Palestine is not in the media, and if it is, it's heavily distorted. So I think that education, waking other people up who might not know, who might be sitting on the fence and not quite understand what this is all about. And challenging, I mean, it's not a conflict. Unfortunately, that's one thing that the media likes to say. This is an age-old conflict. It isn't. It's about the colonization of a land that people were already living in, and the continued occupation of this land and the brutal policies that come with that. And I think that we need to challenge our media. We need to challenge our politicians. And we need to be heard and say that we no longer support, we shouldn't have in the first place, but we no longer support Israeli policies against the Palestinian people.
Mm. Well, thanks so much. I've been speaking with Eva Bartlett. She's an independent Canadian activist, freelance journalist as well. She's spent long periods in both the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip with the International Solidarity Movement. She'll be speaking tomorrow in Portland at the Red and Black Cafe at 5 p.m. That's Thursday, December 12th at 5 p.m. Her website is ingaza.wordpress.com. That's ingaza.wordpress.com. Thanks for joining us, Eva Bartlett.
Thank you very much.
I'm Jenka Soderberg with KABU Radio. عنك عمري ما تحققوني يا حبيبتي نسمعوا أنا عاشق بسمع
Finally, the housing market is recovering. Sales and prices are up. But wait, home ownership is still going down. That's right. The banksters are at it again. This time, they've bought up 200,000 foreclosed homes, bundled them to sell as rental-backed securities. A new financial instrument is born, creating a new housing bubble. Join me, Linda Olson-Osterlund, on a deeper look this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. My guest is Laura Gottsdiener, author of How Wall Street Has Turned Housing Into a Dangerous Get-Rich-Quick Scheme Again. That's this Thursday at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO.
It's 9:31. You're listening to KABU Radio. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia will be with us. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints. And at 11 o'clock, it's The Dirt Bag, talking about bees today with the president of the Portland Urban Beekeepers Association. And coming right up, we are going to go to Radio EcoShock today, reporting on Fukushima updates. Thanks for tuning in to KABU.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm your reporter, Alex Smith. I need to alert you to yet another disgusting development coming from the world's nuclear mafia. It's a general go-ahead to dump hundreds of thousands of tons of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. Incredibly, everyone from the American head of the NRC to the International Energy Agency and Japanese authorities are giving a green light to empty those thousands of radioactive tanks at Fukushima right into the ocean. Who gives anyone permission to make the seas more radioactive? Why can't the country that used dangerous nuclear power keep the inevitable mess to themselves? Let's dig in deeper to recent developments at the triple meltdown that is the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear catastrophe. It's hardly worth mentioning Fukushima has set a new all-time record for radioactive pollution just this month.